This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Chicago's Morning Answer. Eric Cohn and Joe Kaiser filling in for Dan and Amy today and tomorrow and Wednesday. So
it's too much, some might say. Not us, but them.
Yeah. Us and them, yeah. Probably. So if you like the content of the program today, be sure to come back Tuesday and Wednesday. And if you don't like the content of the program, well, join the club.
Still come back Tuesday and Wednesday.
What else do you have to do?
If you're up at what time is it?
It's 5 a.m.
5:11 right
5:11.
Now. If you're up at this hour, what else do you have to do anyway?
Exactly.
So even if you don't like it, tune in. Call in.
Exactly. Call in, yes. Be a part of the program. Give us a call at 312-642-5600, or you can text us at 64636 and put DA at the beginning of your message to 64636. Together, Joe and I host the program Sources with Knowledge, heard every weekend on this station, Newstalk 560, The Answer, at 8 a.m. on Saturday mornings and again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. So if you like our talk stylings, you can pick us up at your friendly local podcast feed and make that a regular part of your week.
This is so many opportunities this week to hear us.
Yes.
Today,
yes.
Tomorrow, Wednesday, Saturday and Sunday. Never mind that the Saturday and Sunday show is the same show. You can hear it again on Sunday,
yes,
if you like it on Saturday.
Yes.
And now, call in, text in, today, tomorrow, Wednesday. You have an opportunity to improve the show yourself.
Yes. And let's be honest, the odds that you're going to make us better are pretty high.
Yeah. So
pretty high.
Please do so.
Joe, did you have a nice Christmas?
Yeah. It's obviously a little different this year with, you know, I mean, it was relatively normal, immediate family, but the idea of, you know, trying to keep a distance, checking with people, seeing where they've been, mm-hmm. Did things differently with my sister and brother-in-law. They, you know, saw other people, his family, so we separated, met on different days, met outside, that kind of thing. But I'm just kind of used to it, you know?
Yeah.
What about you?
It was nice, and yes, it is. It is odd, and the odd part of it is the just utter lack of leaving the house. We still try to go places, and we still try to do things to the extent that we can, but hey, we live in the Chicagoland area, and I don't know if you know this, it gets cold.
Yeah.
And it is not as much fun to be outside in the freezing cold like that. So, I mean, but, you know, it's nice. We've tried for years now. I've got two kids, 10 and 7. And we've tried for the last several years now to not travel during Christmas. So we're actually fairly used for Christmas being home. Being home for Thanksgiving was a little, that was more different than we would normally expect.
Sure. And the weird part isn't being home for Christmas necessarily, or home for Thanksgiving, whatever holiday you didn't travel for. The weird part is being home December 21st, 2nd, 3rd,
yeah,
with no other,
yeah,
option. And then you're home for Christmas. So it just feels like it kind of blends in with other days when Christmas is not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be special and different. I think the one thing that was different this year is Thanksgiving, Christmas, soon to be New Year's, just feels like any given Tuesday.
Yeah, as Dave Barry put it in his Year in Review column, I think we're in the March of Pandember.
Yes.
Which is not to be confused with Mapril, which was definitely a month that happened. I'm still not 100% convinced that it is not April still. I feel like this is like April 8th, because that's what it feels like to me.
It is weird because, like, so the NBA season just started, the NHL season is going to start. These were two things that were postponed at the start of the pandemic, and it feels like the same season. I know it's a different season. There were champions. We moved on. There's technically an off season. Sports kind of feels the same. It feels like it's all blending together. And, I mean, I looked at my phone just now again to look at the date. Would have no idea. I know it's December because of Christmas, that it's the 28th.
And yeah, I had to ask my wife in the car yesterday. It was like, it'd be two days ago. It's like it's Saturday, right? And she's like, yes, it's Saturday. Because I had no idea. It was like I was thinking. It was like, wait, I actually have to go to bed early tonight because I got to get up and come out here to the studio for this program. And yeah, I still have zero concept of what day it is. And that is the thing with the kind of locked in the house. And it has been better as the year has gone on, because like we're not all staying inside to the extent that we were back in, say, April and May. We're not wiping down our groceries anymore. We're not doing all the crazy things that we were doing that now really seem crazy the more that we've come to learn about this virus and this pandemic. But yeah, it still does seem to all blend together. And I think your point about like sports leagues and all of that, only for us, for me at least, seems to make it more confusing, because I just have, you know, it's January when the NHL season is going to start. The, you know, having the NBA on Christmas was normal, but having it just start then, it was not normal.
Right. Yeah. It's all that it kind of messes up the calendar in my head. Also, I mean, we're not doing the weird things now that we did in March and April, but because, as you mentioned at the outset of this conversation, we're in Chicagoland. The winter does feel a little bit heavier in that regard. I mean, I outdoor dined this weekend for lunch because it was like 40, which is weird. I'm looking at the calendar now, or the weather for next weekend, thinking, oh, it's going to be 35 and sunny. Maybe I can go out and have lunch somewhere.
Yeah, have a meal
outside.
That's
crazy. Yeah.
Was it actual outdoor dining? Like, were you sitting completely out in the open?
Yes. Well, in a tent, but the tent was open. It had a heater.
See, this is the thing that I don't get. There are so many things about this, the response that we have had to this pandemic, that I find baffling and that I think most people find baffling. And this is one of them. You see these photos of these like igloo things. Mm. You see these photos of these tents that have been constructed outside that are enclosed, that have their own air circulation and heating systems, because it would be intolerable to sit outside in a tent in Chicago in December otherwise. But they're indoor dining.
Right,
these are not outdoor dining spots. They are indoor dining. And we're being expected to lie to ourselves and tell ourselves that this is outdoor dining. It's not. It's indoor dining in a tent, which nobody has yet to be able to explain to me how it is markedly different from being inside a brick and mortar building.
It's funny. So my parents were trying to find a place for our family to meet and have lunch. And we were calling a couple places saying, do you have heated outdoor dining? Do you have like a tent? What's your situation? And I said, sarcastically, wouldn't it be great if one of these restaurants had not just heated outdoor dining, but four brick walls, so that's very enclosed, with a roof overhead and heat going all the time.
Yeah.
That would be a great invention. I think next year some restaurant should pursue that, and I would definitely go to that.
That would be that's a fascinating idea. You should float that to some people and see what they what they think.
Call in if you like it.
Yeah. You want to be a part of that business venture, give us a call, and Joe will happily make you a part of that business venture. But no, that is one of those suspension of disbelief kinds of things that we have had to deal with this year. Of look, some things, and not to review the whole pandemic, but I guess we can do that to a certain extent. Things at the beginning that seemed to make sense, as time went on, made less sense. Mm-hmm. And the restaurant part of it is one of the more baffling things to me, because the difference between, there was a story from, I think it was from Tim Carney at the Washington Examiner, who has a large family, and it would be eight total of them if they all sat down together, but there was a limit of six. So he had to split up with him and three of his kids at one table, and his wife with three of their kids at the other table, which makes no sense whatsoever, right? Because they've all been living in a house together.
Right. Yeah. It makes absolutely no sense. Just because you're changing the venue of a restaurant. It messes with the way we view, especially restaurants and bars, because they've been closed and we've been looking at being in a packed restaurant or a packed bar is kind of irresponsible. It messes with the way we, if you don't think too critically about it, the way we view just a very simple act of sitting down and eating. Like when we were in this restaurant over the weekend, sitting in the tent, I'm not going to say what the restaurant was because they weren't exactly following the rules, but there were a bunch of people inside, and I was thinking about it. We're sitting 20 feet from the inside, and we're kind of thinking, oh, they're being irresponsible. What if they just opened a window? How different is it really to begin with?
Yeah. It's one of those rule things that just doesn't make sense. Like back in nicer weather, where if you had like the big doors in front of some restaurants in the city, where if you open them up, people could sit right there on the inside of the building as long as they're right next to the door. And none of it makes sense. If any of it makes sense to you, if none of it makes sense and you just want to rant about it like we have been, Give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text us 64636. Put DA at the front of your message to 64636. Ericone, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Ericone, Joe Kaiser filling in for Dan and Amy. Be a part of the program. Give us a call at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text us. Text 64636. Text DA to 64636 with your comment. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Craig in Mount Greenwood. Craig, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Eric and Joe. Good to hear you guys. Listen, it's all a big bunch of bullcrap from these rotten leftist politicians, the socialist punks. They're just doing this for the power grab and to take and destroy America. They're destroying this place. They're destroying our lives. And I wish people would catch on and figure it out. I know all kinds of people that have had it and had such small symptoms and everything like that. Some of them no symptoms, none, nothing. This is all made up stuff in here with this thing here. The only people that have problems is the people with serious respiratory conditions, and that's it. And if anybody got it and they had a real bad case, they could take the ivermectin. They'd be better right away. The ivermectin works. That other malaria medication works in the first week. But then after that, you do the ivermectin, and you're better right away. They got all kinds of doctors. They keep pulling down that we're telling. They say they got 100% success rate saving people with that stuff.
Yeah. So, Craig, I think one of the thanks so much for the call. One of the things that I actually saw over the weekend is the percentage of people in the fatality column for COVID-19. The connections that they have to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, I believe it is upwards of 45% are connected directly to nursing homes, assisted living facilities like that. And that is one of the great overlooked parts of all of this, in part because, you know, there are people in the media who are running interference for a lot of politicians like mm-hmm. Andrew Cuomo in New York, and they do not want to pay attention to the fact that they handled that part of it terribly.
Right. And that's what the other illogical thing is. Sure, be safe in a restaurant or a bar. Don't go if you don't feel safe. I get all that. But then why is all the attention focused on restaurants when the statistic you just mentioned?
Yeah. The focus should have always been on those, and we knew this pretty early on in the process, those who were most susceptible to it, which is how we're going about, in some cases, we'll get to this in a little bit, I assume, prioritizing who gets the vaccine, mm-hmm. that the people who are most vulnerable to this should be first in line for the vaccine. That makes sense in the same way that it makes more sense to deal with places that, like nursing homes and assisted living facilities, where the population is most susceptible to all of this. But there's always been this weird reverse egalitarian thing where everybody has to live like everybody else, irrespective of their personal risk, irrespective of the likelihood of it being a big problem for them.
Yeah, and that's, I think, where we are with pretty much every aspect of how we talk about COVID. And it's very bizarre, and we'll look back at this one day, and I think that'll be a big takeaway, is how we treated it in just judging how other people live and thinking how everyone needs to live based on my own risks and my own values when I go out and how I handle the pandemic.
Yep.
It's very odd.
Yep.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Ericone, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy this morning. Joe, that traffic report reminded me of something, which is there are so many things that I cannot wait until they get back to normal and the way they were before. Traffic is one of those that if we could keep these conditions the same, because like I can get up and down Lakeshore. I can get up and down the Kennedy with almost no traffic whatsoever at almost any time of the day, which is glorious.
And that,
so
that's going to be a weird adjustment.
Like, that is going to be a very weird adjustment.
And there are so many adjustments that are going to be great to go back to go to a restaurant, to go to a sporting event, to a concert, whatever. Going back to rush hour traffic, if you commute in rush hour, is going to be a horrible adjustment. Not to make things bleak, but you know.
I'd rather not. I'd rather not do it. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to line two and Nick on the northwest side. Nick, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I was going to ask, how is it that the Democrats, which I don't mind if they get the credit for it, I'm a conservative guy, but how is it they say that they're going to consider voting on that and passing an increase? I thought when Trump signed that paperwork, that 5,000-plus page monstrosity, I thought that concludes that piece, and a separate thing has to be started all over again. Do you know anything about that? How can they do that? And, of course, they probably need support from the Republicans with their votes also. Do you have any information about that?
So, Nick, thanks for the call. My understanding of the package, and we're going to have Veronique DeRougi on Wednesday to break down all of the stuff that is in this COVID relief bill. But what they've also done is they've coupled it. And this is the way that Congress works now, is they have coupled the bill that will keep the government open, because we don't do budgets anymore. There's no budgetary process. There's no real approach to it that tries to create priorities of this is what we should be spending money on. This is what we should actually be doing. We just have these continuing resolutions that continuing the previous spending that was happening. And they usually end up attaching stuff that they want to get passed to it, like the COVID relief bill. So these things have happened together. Now, what President Trump is supposedly doing, if you read the signing statement that he released when he signed this, is that he is going to use the Impoundment Act to try to line item out the spending in there that he thinks is larded up, that's pork. The odds that that is going to happen, though, I got to be honest with you, they're very slim, pretty much to none. In the same way that he's also requesting that they go back now and increase, now that he signed the bill that provides the $600 payments, to go back and increase it to $2,000, Congress is just not going to do that. And we can debate the merits of the argument for the $2,000, but Congress is just, they're not going to do it. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and that's why, just to boil it down, everyone's talked about these different items of spending that's been frustrating to see being talked about while they're talking about a stimulus. That's because of what you said, Eric. They're just coupling everything together.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it works now. And it's very frustrating if you're just a casual observer of this kind of stuff and you're very interested in seeing the stimulus passed, as anybody is in this country.
Yeah.
And so that's why you're following it. And then you see, you know, a line item for however millions of dollars for gender studies in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And I get that that's frustrating, but it's a bigger issue.
We are not making that one up.
Yeah.
That one is in there. Gender studies in Pakistan, one of those absolutely important things. For me, you can trace so many of our problems back to one big problem, and that is Congress does not do its job anymore. Part of its job, especially in the House, is to originate spending programs and budgets like this. Congress does not do that. They just carry forward the previous spending and all of that. That is, even the members of Congress don't seem to run to want to be legislators. They run to be like to get a better slot on cable news or to get a larger Twitter following, which is just not the way that this system is supposed to work. And if we want to look at this individual spending bill and what the president said in terms of wanting to take it from $600 to $2,000, I actually look, the kind of Tea Party me, I was a spokesman for the Chicago Tea Party for just about as long as that group existed, would have been generally outraged by the idea of spending this kind of money. But so many people are in this situation because of action that the government has taken. They chose to shut down the economy. And we can debate the merits of that. We can set that aside, though, because it was the government's decision. It was politicians' decision to shut down the economy. Relief for people in dire straits through no fault of their own makes sense. What I'm angry about is the fact that in the last, most of the last 20 years, we have been spending money like crazy when we didn't need to be. In good economic times, in regular times, take the Great Recession out of it, we were spending money like crazy, running up all kinds of debt and deficits. And now at a time when we need to spend money, we're shooting it up to $4-5 trillion of debt, which we're going to have to pay for at some point in time.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's a bad habit. So now it's just going to be part of, we need to spend money, but it's just those bad habits that have accumulated over decades. It's just going to be more of the same once they actually need to spend money. And that's what you're seeing now. And it's doubly frustrating because everyone wants to see something passed, but these spending habits of Congress that have existed for so long are not going to change overnight. They're not going to change in the next week when they need to change.
No, they're not going to change until the incentives in Congress change.
Exactly.
Until people in Congress start acting like they have some responsibility there, and the odds of that happening anytime soon are pretty slim. Let's go to Peggy on line 3 in Chicago. Peggy, good morning.
Good morning. I am so happy. I just want to leap for joy. You know how sometimes some serendipitous things just happen? And I happened to be listening to your station. It was last night or something. Anyway, they were talking about this bill that the president had signed. And this lady called in and she said, oh, by the way, did you know that by signing that bill, he negated the whole thing? And I said, well, really? How did this happen? And I thought, it was just a fluke. He didn't intend it. He just signed it, and by doing it the way he did it, he negated the whole silly thing. And, of course, I don't know if that's true or not. But
yeah,
Peggy,
I'm not sure what you mean by negated. I mean, the bill as it was sent to him has now been signed into law, so the spending is going to happen, the relief checks are going to go out.
Well, she said no, and she's an attorney. Now, the thing is, the thing I want to tell you is that, you know, the government has never really been shut down. People have never really, where the government just closed, and they just locked the doors, and they said, bye, folks. You know, it's
right.
Closed. And I'm thinking, well, this is going to be a surprise, won't it? You know, it's like, it's the year when everybody got what they wanted for Christmas. Because some people said, you know, they said, what they should do with those folks is just kick them out. I said, well, how about if we lock the doors and tell them to go home and not pay them? And I thought, well, you got what you wanted for Christmas. You know, and I, it's
right,
like,
right.
All these people who really thought, man, if I was in charge, I'd really do it. And through no fault of his own, I mean, just it was a fluke. And I thought, on your face, Grace, be grateful for this. You know, because if it actually happens, if they find out it's true, because they won't find out in time. Even if they suspect it, they won't find out in time.
Well, Peggy, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. The people's anger at Congress, especially, she makes an interesting point about shutdowns, Joe. I remember the Ted Cruz initiated shutdown over Obamacare. It's amazing when you find out that we've had so many conversations about what is essential and non-essential in terms of the economy, in terms of individual people's lives. And you find out that so much of government, like Congress, you know, we can debate the essentialness of Congress. And they, look, Congress is essential in a sense, but they should essentially be doing their job. So many of the departments that they were able to shut down and things seemed to operate fine, people's lives operated fine, should be a lesson, an instructive lesson about how big the Leviathan of the federal government has become, that you can shut a lot of these agencies down. And most people are just fine.
Yeah, it's interesting about government shutdowns. I remember maybe it was the Ted Cruz one on Obamacare. It might have been even before that, sometime around 2010, 2012, when we first started talking about the fear of a government shutdown, what's going to happen. We haven't had one of these in however many years. Now it feels like we talk about this every year, every other year, and on the state level too sometimes.
Right.
Talk about just the government. Illinois government just wasn't doing anything for like 2 years. A few years ago.
There's no budget in for 2 years.
And your life just kind of went on as it is. It's amazing how that works.
And the biggest consequence of it was the gigantic bill backlog here in Illinois, which was already big, got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
That really was the big outcome of the 2 years, which, of course, ended in a gigantic tax increase that, oh, by the way, didn't come close to fixing any of our problems. But yes, the the thing about the government shutdown, the idea of a government shutdown, is that it never really does shut down.
Right.
Peggy's absolutely right about that. It never actually does shut down. And the way that it is often handled by the people who are in charge is to do the same thing that I remember Pat Quinn, when he was governor of Illinois, always would do in this stupid argument over budget and tax increases, is to say, well, if I don't get what I want, if I don't get the tax increase that I want, the first thing that's going to go is we're going to have to shut down all of the police and the fire and the hospitals. And that is so transparently obvious for what it is. Yeah. It's a Mayor Quimby Simpsons kind of move to say that that's the first thing that you go to. It's ridiculous, and people should recognize it for being ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not the bureaucrats. We're going to look at the budget, what has to go. We're going to get rid of teachers, firefighters, and police officers. There's nothing else we can do.
Yeah, we're always going to hold the people hostage that people could actually agree on probably should continue to exist. Let's go to line one and Ed in Oak Brook. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, and thank you very much for being there today. Better than those repeat shows that they've been putting on. But the thing is, maybe it's just me, but you know what? I just can't wrap my head around this election. The COVID stuff really doesn't bother me. The stimulus thing does bother me. But the theft of this election.
Well, go back to the stimulus thing, Ed. Go back to the stimulus thing. Why does that bother you?
Well, what I've heard is like the amount of pages involved, and if you wanted to help the people of this country, then you know what? All that should have been in there was the unemployment continuation, because as you guys pointed out, the government shut all these businesses down.
Mm-hmm.
And the increase of $600, it's a night out. It's probably for you guys, that's a good night out. But for most people, that's nothing. That ain't going to help anybody. But when I hear things like that $10 million for Pakistan Women's Study and all those other programs that are out of this country, that just boils me. It just kills me, because you look at this state, okay, and the misspending by the previous administrations and so forth, you know what, that money can go here. And because I know people with special needs children and adults with Alzheimer's and so forth, that money could go to them. Because you know what, if you have a special needs kid, you're hurting every single day, and to see that they don't get any relief at all, not in their tax return or anything like that, but yet they're going to give millions and millions. Why? That's what kills me. Why? Is Pakistan voting here? Maybe they are.
Yeah.
Who knows? But this election thing is.
Ed, thanks for the call. No, I agree on the fact the way that we've approached the stimulus thing has been annoying to me, because the idea that I was not the first one to proffer this, I was definitely not, although I'll take credit for it. Why not? Rather than sending direct checks out to people, what we should have done is the government should have backstopped private payrolls. If they were going to shut businesses down, have the government guarantee private payrolls and keep people attached to their jobs.
It's crazy that net doesn't come up.
This seemed obvious to me. Most people, if they have health insurance, it's attached to their jobs. That's a whole other issue that we can get into. But that seems like the obvious way to handle this, rather than shutting everything down, having this period of time where Congress kind of looks at each other and goes, what do we do about this? And then they cut checks once, and now they're going to do it a second time.
Because ultimately, even no matter what you think about the pandemic, what you think about shutdowns in general, it is a government forced shutdown that's causing businesses to close. It's not COVID coming in and telling the business to stop running. It is the government telling businesses to stop running. So the logical thing to do would be for government to come in and help them out and help with their payrolls. But that doesn't even, it's not even talking
Keeping
about.
Keeping people attached to their jobs seems like the obvious answer. But of course, this is the government we're talking about, and obvious doesn't really factor into it. Be a part of the program with us. 312-642-5600, 312-642-5600. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy. Give us a call, 312-642-5600, to be a part of the program, or you can text us. Text DA and your message to 64636. Joe, going back to the idea we were just discussing of how Congress should have approached handling the economic impacts of the pandemic and the response to the pandemic. One of the benefits that we would have seen from the idea of the government guaranteeing private payrolls would hopefully have been to avoid a lot of the business closures that we have seen. And I was going through a list yesterday, I was trying to pull it up, but I couldn't quite find it, of a tracker of all of the bars and restaurants that have closed. And those are places, there are a lot of places in there. There was one that I'd only been to once, but was a place in Humboldt Park called the California Clipper, which was a fairly cool dive-ish kind of bar. You also had Pippin's on Rush Street, which is like the only thing on Rush Street that was like close to a dive bar.
Yes.
That you can go in and get some reasonably priced drinks and not pay like, you know, $18 for a Manhattan. These are places that are irreplaceable and they're going to be gone forever as a result of all of this. And I would like to hope that a program similar to the guaranteeing of payrolls could have avoided a lot of these closures that are just places that are part of the character of the Chicagoland area and the city of Chicago that we just cannot snap our fingers and get back.
Yeah, and I'm almost amazed sometimes when I see certain establishments that are still powering through right now. Like, some have adapted and found innovative ways to keep going. But I know of dive bars that I like and small mom-and-pop restaurants that are somehow still going, and I love it. But if this keeps going to March, April, I just don't know how any of these places survive without a little assistance.
Yes. And look, there is an extension of the Paycheck Protection Act that is in the bill that the president just signed, that Congress passed. I think that was probably one of the more successful programs that we had. It still was a bureaucratic nightmare, though, because you had to go through the process of applying for these funds. You would have still, even in the program I'm suggested, some process of applying for all of these funds. But it was a limited program with certain qualifications. And the impact, particularly on the bar and restaurant world, you know, these are people that are going to be not only detached from their jobs and their income as a result of all of this, they're be detached from their health care as a result of all of this. It is amazing how this is the industry that has been just kind of batted around most by this whole situation. And it is, as somebody who really enjoys, like, dining out is the thing that my wife and I like to do. We don't really take vacations. We never taken vacations. Or dining out, going to good restaurants, and enjoying the character of this city is something we really love to do. And there's just a lot of places that it just kind of breaks my heart to see that they just, especially when you see and you've read these messages that they post on social media about these restaurants that have been open or in the family for 20, 30, 40 years. And they have no choice but to close because the insanity of the way that they've approached even the policies of, like, well, you can open at 25% capacity. What government bureaucrat or politician knows if that business can operate at 25% capacity?
Right, and then going back and forth, like just flipping back and forth, especially you hear this in other states too, not just Illinois. California's a big one. You're open, you're closed, you're open, you're closed. You're at 25% capacity, you're at 50% capacity. These are it's so difficult to keep up with. And to put a more optimistic tone on that, though, it's so impressive to see how many of these places have adapted and innovated and tried new things. Creativity that bureaucrats and the government could never imagine. And it's amazing to see this, especially in restaurants, because they've just been, you know, treated so poorly and bounced around and just not thought of as important to their communities, really. It is so impressive to see how they've innovated, how they've been creative throughout this whole thing to still be here now. And I think that's like just a testament to being an entrepreneur, is that kind of creativity.
Two words for you, Joe. One of them hyphenated. To-go cocktails.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. That is something that absolutely, of all the things from this experience that should stick around, that is one of them that should stick around. To-go cocktails.
Yes, absolutely. And I think hopefully it will. There are some good things that might come of this because we've reimagined the way we do so many things just in our everyday life. To-go cocktails should be at the top of that list of things that stick around.
Absolutely.
Not hurting anybody.
Absolutely. As fun as it is to mix a Manhattan on my own at home to just have the kit put together for me, just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Chicago's Morning Answer. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. With our combined powers, we are the hosts of Sources with Knowledge, heard weekends on this station, 8 a.m. on Saturdays, and again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. You can search Sources with Knowledge in any podcast feed you like, and you can find our program there. Would you be part of the program with us this morning? Give us a call at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text a message. Text DA and your message to 64636. That's DA and your message to 64636.
Sources with Knowledge, the name, if you've listened to the first hour, if you listened to us before, and if you listen to us for the rest of today and the next 2 days, you'll know is somewhat self-deprecating, too.
A little bit.
We don't take ourselves too seriously with that one.
I mean, knowledge is pretty general. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't say what we have knowledge
sure.
of.
Sure, yeah.
We just said we're sources and we have knowledge.
Yeah, it could be about a lot of things. And if you listen to our program on the weekends, you will find out all about that.
Especially our searing fast food takes, which is, to me, my favorite part of the program
yeah.
every week.
We close out every show with a little bit of knowledge about food, fast food, restaurants. We're talking about a lot about restaurants today, but not just about policy that affects them, but about the important things like best fast food hamburger, best yeah. fast food dessert, Taco Bell's new menu items.
And then we close the program pretty much every week by begging whatever fast food restaurant we talked about to give us a call and sponsor the program. You know what, Joe? We are 68 episodes into our program, and not a single one has taken us up on that offer.
Perseverance, though.
Yes.
A million no's, one yes, that's all it takes.
That's you got to keep asking. The answer's
yeah.
no until you ask.
Exactly.
It's always no until you ask. So we spent a lot of the first hour, Joe, talking about, kvetching a little bit about the difficulties throughout 2020. But I really liked an editorial yesterday from the Chicago Tribune, which was headlined, "The best time to be alive is now." And I think we should take a few minutes to reflect on that, what I think is a reality. Look, we can all look around and we can identify the things that are bothering us that we think aren't right with the world. One of the reasons I think we can see them so clearly is because if we look back through the course of human history, things are good.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of pandemic that we're living through right now, 50 years ago, likely would have been the kind of thing that would have resulted in 10 times as many deaths as we've seen. Every one of those lives are precious.
Well, we have examples of that, too.
There are plenty of historical examples of that. Another way that this has often been driven home to me is natural disasters, hurricanes when they occur, the deaths associated with those hurricanes. They often talk about, like, you can count them at the most oftentimes in the dozens, whereas these kinds of events 50, 60 years ago would have killed untold numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just in that sense as well. There are plenty of others, and the Chicago Tribune, I think, does a good job of pointing a lot of those out. One of the headers is "Believe in Solutions, They Exist." One of the most remarkable stories. If you come away from 2020 wanting to remember the positive things about it, and I think that should be our approach to it. Look, there are plenty of things that we can look at in this year that were terrible, but try to come away and remember the positive things about it. One of those positive things was the Moderna vaccine. Developed in 48 hours. What a remarkable accomplishment, a testament to ingenuity, scientific brilliance, to have it developed in only 48 hours. And this was always going to be our ticket to getting out of the circumstances that we were living in. We just talked in the last hour about the ways that bars and restaurants have innovated and have the, you know, we should mourn for the ones that have closed, but also we should look at the ways that they have found ways to change and do things better. Solutions exist out there, and we should recognize the ones that have been undertaken and recognize them for what they are. The story of the vaccine in particular is one of is going to be one of the most miraculous accomplishments in human history. That somebody made this point to me that the vaccine for smallpox took something like 3,000 years. This took 48
hours. It's incredible. Yeah, and it really is amazing. It's hard. I get that it's hard to pull positives out of everything that's happened when you look at not just even if you know somebody that has been affected by the virus or somebody that's lost their job, but if you look at the numbers of people that have died, that have been infected, or businesses that have closed, it's really hard to come away at the end of this calendar year and say, look at the positives. But when we look back at this, we'll be amazed at the ingenuity. We talked about the creativity of restaurants, the innovation there. We'll talk about the vaccine is going to be the biggest story,
yep,
I think, easily. And it really is amazing. I have always said that, at least at a macro level, every day is pretty much better than the day before it. And it's really hard when you go through your daily life and you have a lot of variables that might bring you down to think of things like that. But just take a step back and think about what we accomplished this year, even in the face of such horrible adversity around the world. And it really is remarkable, and it really is inspiring. And it, I think it makes people think, or it should make people think, that no matter what the next challenge is, if this is another one of these or something of this magnitude, I think you should be inspired or think optimistically that we can handle it, that the world can handle it. And that's in face of the death toll, in face of unemployment. But I think we've shown that, I mean, just the vaccine production alone shows that we have the ingenuity to overcome a lot of horrible global challenges.
The Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker is quoted in this piece from the Chicago Tribune. This is just incredible perspective. Quote, "The poor may not always be with us. The world is about 100 times wealthier today than it was two centuries ago. And the prosperity is becoming even more evenly distributed across countries and people. Within the lifetimes of most readers, the rate of extreme poverty could approach zero. Catastrophic famine, never far away in the past, has vanished from all but the most remote and war-ravaged regions, and undernourishment is in steady decline." He also points out that Americans over the last century have become 96% less likely to be killed in an auto accident, 99% less likely to die in a plane crash, 59% less likely to fall to their deaths, 92% less likely to die in a fire, and 95% less likely to be killed on the job. He might have added to this, the Tribune points out, "The remarkable reductions in infant mortality, in illiteracy, in cancer deaths, and in chronic joblessness." You don't have to go all that far back for a time when most parents would have experienced the death of a child. And it's just, it is shocking to us now when it happens because it is so unthinkable. You can go back to when Calvin Coolidge was in the White House and his son was playing tennis on the White House tennis courts, got a blister, it got infected, and his son died from it. That was in the 1920s. 100 years later, that kind of thing is completely unthinkable. It is remarkable how our conditions have improved, and we should be more cognizant of it.
I like that you said that some of these tragedies are tragic in part because they're just so rare now, and that's, I think, what you should take away from a lot of the tragedies that happened, where, what did you say, 96% with automobiles?
96% less likely to be killed in an auto accident, 99% less likely to die in a plane crash, 59% less likely to fall to your death, 92% less likely to die in a fire, and 95% less likely to be killed on the job.
That's, it's incredible, especially the flight and automobile statistics. My favorite anecdote on this, and this is going to sound kind of stupid, but I think about this a lot.
It's on brand for us.
On this topic, working class people today have a infinitely far better quality of life than monarchs from just a few hundred years ago. Just based on the fact alone that you can poop indoors. I mean, it's not...
Running water and indoor plumbing is rather miraculous.
It is.
And
it's relatively new.
Yeah.
It is an incredible invention. Changes the quality of life. It is surprisingly new. And just based off ingenuity like that alone, people have a better... Just across the board have a better quality of life than the wealthiest people 300 years ago, 200 years ago, whatever. Pull out a date that you want.
No, for people who are concerned about pollution... I'm concerned about pollution. The car, the automobile, is a pollution reducer.
Mm-hmm.
Despite what Al Gore and some people like that would tell you, the automobile is a pollution reducer. Because just think to yourself what the streets of Chicago would look like if we were still riding around on horses. Because you mentioned, Joe, pooping indoors. Horses don't do that.
No.
They often do it just wherever they are.
That's one thing that we haven't found is how to get horses to poop in the toilet.
Yeah. And look, I'm not saying in the context of this Tribune editorial that there aren't still advances that we can make as a society. Getting horses to use the toilet, getting dogs to use the toilet are one of those advances, but we're not there yet. But Joe, we have to have something to strive for. We need to have goals. And just think, the person who figures out how to get dogs to use the toilet, just think how much money there is to be made there.
Absolutely. And that person should be praised just as much as the people who invented and advanced indoor plumbing.
That is Nobel Prize stuff.
Yes. Indoor plumbing is amazing. I'm just saying, we don't talk about it enough. I mean, call in if you want to. But indoor plumbing is amazing. And this whole topic, not the poop stuff, but just the macro thing, is kind of how people talk about race relations and gender relations. Yes, there are still challenges.
Yes,
it is still a problem. Yes, we need to improve all the time. But think about how far we've come.
Think about how much better things have gotten. The final segment of this Tribune editorial is "Don't Let Bleakness Win." And it quotes one of my favorite people, former head of the American Enterprise Institute, Arthur Brooks. "There is a natural human bias toward bad news. The title of a 1998 article in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology sums it up. Negative information weighs more heavily on the brain. Negative stimuli get our attention much more than positive stimuli, which makes evolutionary sense for survival. Nice things are enjoyable. Bad things can be deadly. So focus on them." And given that, in the news media, attention equals money, we can see the commercial reason for a lack of headlines such as "millions not going to bed hungry tonight." That is something for which we should have gratitude. Gratitude for the conditions of the world. We want to know what you have gratitude for. Give us a call at 312-642-5600 to be a part of the program with us today. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy today. 312-642-5600 if you want to be a part of the program. Joe, give me that fact that you gave me off the air once we finished that last segment.
Indoor plumbing was first invented, so to speak, in the 1840s. But by 1940, so 100 years later and less than 100 years ago from right now, nearly half of houses, lacked hot piped water, a bathtub, a shower, or a flush toilet in 1940.
Just imagine for a moment living like that.
I grew up in a cul-de-sac with about four houses. That means, statistically speaking, if it was 1940, two of those houses would be pooping outside. That is amazing. 1940.
Yeah. And you can probably attest, too, that like your neighbors might have been nice, but that's nothing that you would want to experience if just happened to walk outside and be like, George, gosh.
I don't want to witness it. And that's less than 100 years ago.
Less than 100 years ago. Let's go to line one, Mark in South Holland. Mark, good morning.
How are you, gentlemen?
Doing fine. How are you?
Great.
You know what? Kids are eating. Some of the bills are getting paid, so I'm happy.
Can't complain.
All right. So, you know, I am a plumbing contractor, And I will tell you that I do teach plumbing, and we also know that the downfall of most of societies were always based around pandemics, which were caused by sanitation most of the time. And I agree that, you know, without a sanitized environment, clean drinking water, we know that that has created a ton of pandemics that have killed people throughout time. And I do want to just quickly say thank you guys for this topic. We need to start looking at what are we going to do to contribute to making things better, not focusing on the things that are making things bad.
Mark, thank you so much for listening. That it, look, a plumbing contractor.
Perfect.
One, God bless you. I mean,
thank you for your contributions in advancing plumbing.
Thank you for your contributions to society.
Yeah.
I mean, I am not saying that sarcastically or facetiously at all. I mean, what an incredibly important job. And it's the kind of thing that we should have more appreciation for. But it is a testament to how well we live that we don't
exactly
think about it that way.
Yeah. Let's, I just had the statistic less than 100 years ago.
Exactly.
Half of people don't have plumbing.
Exactly. Let's go to line two, John in Portage Park. John, good morning.
Hey, guys. Like the other guy said, thanks for the topic. It's a great, great way to look at things, and everybody should be more positive. But my comment is that even wars have gotten more less lethal because just in my lifetime, I'm almost 60, and you know, we were going to blow ourselves off the earth with atomic war. And I don't hear nobody, you know, complaining about that. And I just one battle in World War II took as many people out in the American Army as, you know, 10 years of Afghanistan. So, yeah, I think the world is just a great place and everybody should just be thankful for what they got.
Amen, John. Thank you so much for the call.
He's absolutely right, but that one point on that is he said 10 years in Afghanistan, that it's changed and evolved in a different way. That's also not good.
No, I mean, look, and the fact that there are still conflicts should bother us.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like, look at the 20th century, two world wars. That doesn't seem likely at all.
No, exactly.
Right now. And we should be, that's something else that we should be grateful for. And we should continue to strive for, you know, a better world and a world without the kind of conflicts. But conflict has been a part of human nature and always will be.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Welcome back to Toilet Talk with Eric and Joe. Give us a flush at 312-642-5600.
It's a crap show.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed it is. God. Radio producers are the best, man. I tell you, they are the best. 312-642-5600, Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy, and trying to talk about some of the great things in the world that are, to me, underappreciated. And Joe had brought up the idea of indoor plumbing, which seems to have struck a nerve. Let's go to line three and Bob in Buffalo Grove. Bob, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener to Dan and Amy. Good talking to you. Piece of trivia. Maybe your people know about it, but who is Thomas Crapper?
Is he the inventor of the toilet?
Yes. That's why we call it a crapper. Another piece of trivia. What profession has saved more lives than anyone in the world? What specific profession?
I'm going to go ahead and say it's something in plumbing. Plumber?
No, it's actually, well, close, but it's civil engineers.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That makes sense.
When you think of the societies that have the cleanest water are the most healthy, productive. You know, you go back to the Romans developing the aqueducts, and then Chicago. People don't realize this. Chicago has the world's largest water filtration plant. And also, we have the largest water reclamation plant in Stickney, where they make the water or the polluted water clean.
Something else, Bob, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Something else, Joe, if you have traveled, you will be able to testify and agree to this. Chicago has just the best default out-of-the-tap drinking water of anywhere I've been.
I'd have to do like a side-by-side Pepsi challenge sort of thing, which would be interesting. But I don't – I've heard that before. I mean, yeah.
It really does. I mean, you know, I still do the Brita filter.
That's,
pitcher
I was gonna say,
thing
that's what I do too, so
fridge.
I can't even think about it. Yeah.
But like, if I just go and get it out of the tap, it's fine. I have been places, Florida in particular.
Sure.
Look, Florida, I like you. I like you a lot. You're crazy, but I like you a lot. But the drinking water, so much better here.
Yeah,
than it is in other places.
Come to think of it, I've been in many a hotels where I can't drink the water out of
it. Nor do you want to think about it. But that is, even that is something remarkable that we should recognize. Go back enough time, and it's essentially taking a drink of water is like rolling the dice.
It's crazy.
You don't have to go back that far to a world where that is a reality. Whereas now, even if it is just kind of like bizarrely tasting but healthy drinking water in Florida, you know you're generally going to be fine. And we know immediately when there's a water main break problem, the incredibly powerful computer that I'm holding in my hand sends me a text message and tells me there's a boil order. I mean, 30 years ago, you have to put out individual phone calls. 40 years ago, people, individual phone calls and a community to let them know that there's a boil order. You wouldn't know that a water main had broken. The ability to communicate like that is remarkable.
That's why it's amazing when there is polluted water, how much of a tragedy and how angry we are that water could be polluted at a time that was commonplace.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to line one and Will in Skokie. Will, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Very interesting topic. My background is in physics, and I've taught at University of Chicago, and I've actually was on the mission specialist waiting list before Challenger blew up, and that ruined the whole thing for people up in space. But just remember, I have a little cell phone here, and even though it's an Android, it's not an Apple, it has like 12 times the computing power of the entire computer on the space shuttle. Okay? Now, you have to remember, I read a book once published in 1900 called The Century in Science. And the things that we didn't know back then, I remember I had a professor of mine who received his doctorate in physics 12 days before they discovered the neutron. So he had his doctorate in nuclear physics before they discovered the neutron.
Oh, wow.
And he just said, hey, I'm obsolete now.
Yeah.
The problem is we have so much more information today, and we have so much more ways of getting the information as the aforementioned cell phone, which is nothing but a big computer.
Mm-hmm.
But the information that's spread, half of it is BS. And, you know, so we have this information, but we have not yet developed our crap detectors. We haven't developed a way to look at it and say, no, this is not right, this is wrong. And that is, I think, going to be the problem for the next century is people become lazy. They don't want to actually research things in a way that can be valid. They will go and they will Google something, and just because Google says it in the first couple of sentences, mm-hmm. you know, then they say that's true. And no, as a physicist and knowing what science is and seeing everybody say, oh, it's science, whenever someone comes to you and says, that's science, especially a politician, ask him what he got in calculus.
Yeah.
If you didn't take any calculus today, you have no reason to talk about
it. It's the rise of like capital T, capital S, the science, which to me is just another form of a public religion.
Shut your mouth, right. Shut your mouth, I'm right, and you're wrong.
Yes.
Okay. Have a good one, gentlemen. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Will.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For the call.
Appreciate it.
People need to be skeptical of information, but I want to put some context on what Will just said there, which is, think about time prior to when you had an incredibly powerful computer in your pocket and you could look up any information, whether it was, you know, whether it was right, whether it was wrong, whether it was a mix of all of that. People still shared stories amongst each other. The rise of the notion of urban myths and urban legends were ways that information, largely not accurate, circulated amongst people. What I don't know, and it would be interesting to talk to somebody who actually studies these kinds of things, is more inaccurate information circulating now, or are we just more aware of it? It's that thing like when you learn a new word, it's like you start to see it and hear it everywhere.
Yeah.
Whereas people are still using it just the same. It just kind of washed over you. I think we're so hyper aware right now of inaccurate information that we think it's worse than ever has been. And maybe it's particularly bad. Maybe it is worse than it's been, I don't know, over the last, like, you know, 10 or 15 years. I don't know that. But I tend to think that we're just paying attention to it more and think it's worse as a result.
I absolutely tend to think that because we're talking about it right now.
Yeah.
We're talking about the idea of inaccurate information. We're having a conversation about it on the radio. People are calling in. We can identify. Will said something about not having a BS detector. I don't know if I put those words in his mouth, but something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we actually will develop that more and more. I think right now this is all still pretty new to us of how much information we can consume in a day from Twitter, Facebook, listening to a podcast, watching cable news. All of it's coming at us, and we don't know what to really do with it. It makes us anxious. It makes us frustrated. It makes us confused. And I think we're still learning how to process having this much information thrown at us at all times. I can go on my phone right now, scroll through Twitter, see what's trending, go on Facebook, see what's trending. And it's just it's too much. It's an overload. And we don't know what to do with it because this is all pretty much new. And I think we will develop more of a BS detector. And I think we actually do, while people fall for fake news and fall for rumors and myths online, I think for the most part, we do a pretty good job at correcting that and having a market correction within ourselves of getting better at consuming information.
You brought up social media, which is something else that a lot of people point to as something that has, you know, made us worse or made society worse. And look, I can accept some form of argument along those lines that I think there is the way that we're divorced from individual face-to-face human interactions and the kind of intimacy you feel with people and the fact that you're not going to launch a tirade on somebody looking at them in face-to-face in the eyes in the same way that you would online. But what it has really just done is revealed certain parts of our human nature. And we have been adjusting throughout all human history to our human nature. I mean, one of the fundamental to me tenets of a conservatism that I believe in is the notion that human nature has no history, that it has not changed, and it is not really changeable. It is just what kind of mechanisms do we build to cope and channel our human nature to productive ends and avoid the way that we have throughout the history of mankind used our human nature in ways that have destroyed ourselves. And we have gotten better at that. And we lack a perspective on just how new something like social media is. Like, I got on Facebook like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, in the course of human history, 15 years is a millisecond. And yeah, it takes some time for us to understand these things and to adapt to them. But we've proven ourselves to really be pretty flexible and able to adapt. And we should be more cognizant of that.
Absolutely. And you brought up the point of people on Facebook and Twitter in particular just launching tirades at anonymous people, just launching insults at people they've never met who are faceless to them. And that's all terrible and I hate it. And it's poison. But how many people do you know who are sick of that kind of thing, who more and more as time goes on hate that aspect of social media, of the anonymous, you know, I won't say threats, but just the insults, the arguments, the relationships that break down with people that you used to have a good relationship with face to face, but over politics on Facebook or something, that relationships deteriorate. People don't like that. And progressively, as more of that has happened, you see more people saying, I hate those Facebook rants, those Facebook threads. I want to get off that. We're already correcting ourselves.
Yeah. We have a remarkable ability to do so, and we should recognize it even more. Let's go back to line one and Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin. Good morning, Marvin.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I think what's happened over the last several decades with different avenues of information coming out, that I don't think it's any more or any less disinformation. I think the disinformation has in some ways become even more outlandish than it used to be. But instead of getting news from Walter Cronkite and he being the only filter, I think a lot of it is that people are more able to recognize the disinformation for what it is. And therefore, you think that there's more. And as far as social media is concerned, I've got younger kids, and they've all gotten off of it. They recognize it for on their own for what I think it is. It's a cancer on society. Nobody talks on Facebook or any of this Instagram stuff about the traffic ticket that they just got or the DUI they got 3 weeks ago. It's all happy. Look at me. Look at how successful I am. And it's all a lot of disinformation.
Yeah, it's Marvin, thanks for the call. That's an interesting point about like the way that social media has been used to kind of curate one's life to appear better than it is. And that's just that's a kind of striving thing. Look, people have done that before social media existed, and they will continue to do it in the world of social media and whatever it becomes afterwards. But again, that's just a part of human nature, and people's ability to look at things that they're doing that aren't positive and say, I'm not going to do it anymore, is part of our
Absolutely.
Way of handling that.
Yeah, and people now, just because of Instagram or however you're using it, have the ability to curate their life to more people in rapid time. And it makes people anxious. It really does when you scroll through your Instagram feed and you see that everyone else's life seems perfect and you think about your own, you're like, but mine's not. That's fake, and I think more people are actually recognizing that that's fake, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. Let's go to line two and Carl on the south side. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. You know, the best invention ever. The source of and cause of most life's problem. The mass production of consumable alcohol.
yes, indeed. As the great Homer Simpson said, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems, right? Absolutely. We talked earlier about the glory of takeout cocktails, and I think he's right on point with that.
Yeah,
right,
there's a theme here. I mean, takeout cocktails, probably the best invention from – I don't want to say invention. I mean, New Orleans has been ahead of the game on this for a while.
The year we all became New Orleans, right, without the public nudity and the poor sanitation.
Right, exactly, yeah. So best thing to come out of 2020 for Chicago, to-go cocktails, best invention of the last – 200 years, 300 years, toilets.
Toilets.
That's what we've discovered in
toilets
the first 2 hours.
Toilets and indoor plumbing, absolutely remarkable invention. If you want to weigh in on that on The Toilet Show with Eric and Joe, 312-642-5600 is the number you call to be a part of the program. Or you can text DA and your message to 64636 to join us on the show today. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy. I want to make a recommendation to you if you're looking for that kind of last minute belated Christmas gift for someone. A great book that someone referred to me earlier this year, came out in August, called 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know and Many Others You Will Find Interesting, from Ronald Bailey, who is the science editor at Reason Magazine, and Marion Tupi, who edits a website called humanprogress.org, which is a fantastic website, which speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about in this hour. Just a little bit of it here. World population will peak at 8 to 9 billion before the end of this century. As the global fertility rate continues to fall from 6 children per woman in 1960, the current rate of 2.4. The global absolute poverty rate has fallen from 42% in 1981 to 8.6% today. Satellite data show that forest area has been expanding since 1982. Natural resources are becoming ever cheaper and more abundant. Since 1900, the average life expectancy has more than doubled, reaching more than 72 years. And as they pointed out, of course, there are major concerns, but there is a lot to be optimistic and hopeful about.
No statistics are just, we've rattled through a bunch before the break, too, that just are startling. It just really puts things into perspective of how far we come in such a short period of time in so many different areas, and we don't appreciate how much progress is made off simple things that we take for granted every day. And I think it's it's really enlightening to take a step back and talk about it a little bit.
And for the things that seem to still plague us, I think one of the things that would really help is just a general sense of gratitude for how remarkably good we actually do have it. And I think just that sense of, if you thought a little bit more about being grateful for how good things actually are, for how good our lives are, despite all the problems and despite everything that we've lived through in this year, that sense of gratitude would just do wonders for your own disposition, for the way you interact with other people. It would make really a huge difference in the way that you view the world, in the way that others view you, in the way that you feel about everything that is going on in the world today.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Eric Cohn. Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. You can hear us every weekend on this station, News Talk 560, The Answer, and our program, Sources with Knowledge, 8 a.m. on Saturdays, and then again at 3 p.m. on Sundays. You can search whatever podcast feed you like to use to find the Sources with Knowledge show, so you can catch up on all 68 previous episodes before this coming weekend's, because, you know, you really, you know, it's one of those programs that you're just not going to fully get it unless you've listened to all 68 previous episodes.
There's a lot of depth to it. You can't just jump in at episode 69 this coming week. You have to get the first 68 episodes in. And here's what you can do.
It would still be a nice experience, but it's just not something
the
that you can do.
The 69th episode will be nice, but you need the first 68 to really appreciate how nice it is. But here's what I recommend people doing. So we're here today. You have us for the rest of Monday until 9 a.m.
Yep.
Then you have us tomorrow, Tuesday. Then you have us Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, catch up on old Sources with Knowledge episodes, 1 through 68. Get as many in as you can. Then have a Saturday at 8 a.m. If it's too deep, if it's too introspective, if it's too complicated, listen to us again on Sunday at 3 p.m.
There you go.
7 days a week.
That's what you can do. Make us your entire week, and you won't regret it, probably. At least we don't think so. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Will Reinhardt, who's a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity, about the antitrust lawsuits that have been filed against Facebook and Google. And coming up at 8 in the next hour, we're going to talk to Jonathan Greenberg, who's a senior fellow at the Chaim Solomon Center, about what we can expect from foreign policy in a Biden administration. And then at 8:30, we'll be talking to James Fitzgerald, who's a retired FBI special agent and criminal profiler from the Unabomber case, author of a number of books about the bombing that happened in Nashville on Christmas Day. We haven't really addressed that yet, Joe, but we will get to that later in the program. What I want to talk about now is, we've been talking in the first hour, we talked about a lot about what's been different about this year, what's been troubling and difficult about this year, all the many things that we could complain about, and, you know, almost kind of a belated Festivus airing of grievances about the year 2020. And then in the last hour, we talked a lot about the things that we should be grateful for and why the world is actually good. We talked about a lot of ways that different institutions out there have adjusted themselves to this new reality. But there are still plenty of people who are thinking things are the same as they've always been, or that we need to get them back to exactly the way that they have been before this pandemic set in March and April. And a perfect example of that is from the luminaries over at the Chicago Sun-Times. Headline of their editorial from yesterday: another big assignment for post-pandemic America, get young people back in college. An additional 560,000 young Americans opted against going to college this past fall, largely because of the pandemic. Joe, I'm going to go ahead and say on this mission, big assignment they're giving, get young people back in college. Or how about not?
Yeah.
How about we don't say we did?
That's an interesting counterpoint.
It is.
I can see both sides of the argument. One, the 700-word editorial from the Chicago Sun-Times mm-hmm. about why I should go back to school. And your counterpoint, which was, how about not? Three words.
Yeah. I have the advantage of being succinct mm-hmm. and pithy. And as has been said, brevity is the soul of wit. So I clearly am wittier than the Chicago Sun-Times, sure. although I
believe bar is kind of low.
A tree stump is wittier than the Chicago Sun-Times. But look, one of the things that has been revealed by the experience we've lived through over the last 9 months or so is how we should look at the way things were before this. And I have for a long time, as somebody was as kids and before too long, my oldest is 10. Before too long, you have to start thinking about, okay, so, you know, getting through elementary school, then into high school, and then what comes after that. And there is this perpetual push for people to go to college. And in a way, that's fine. There are the statistics, the studies that exist out there that, you know, show the increased earning power you get from having gone to college. That's a real thing. Although what is interesting, Joe, is there is an about equivalent bump in that, you know, earning power, quality of living, standard of life that comes from getting married. But you don't see a lot of people out there pushing that one too hard.
Right.
But college, and the weird part about it, too, is the whole getting married thing. You don't have to take on $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 worth of debt. You can just go down to the courthouse and get married, and it will have the same effect on the average.
Sure.
And you can do it without taking on a ridiculous amount of debt. Look, college can be beneficial. I enjoyed my college experience.
I did too, from what I can remember.
Yeah, exactly. And it did set me on a path for success, but that's not something that we need to encourage everyone to do.
Well, yeah, there's not a one size fits all answer to education. It's something that we could talk about ad nauseum, but the idea that every single person is fit for college, and I don't mean in an academic sense of they're not qualified or whatever. I mean, everyone has a different path to a different profession, and to say we all need to push them toward higher education when it might not be right for them and what they're going to end up doing in their life is silly, especially when you mentioned the debt. Chicago Sun-Times has written ad nauseum about student loan debt.
Mm-hmm.
The same editorial board has written several times about the problem of student loan debt. These two things, I don't know how you can unironically write this editorial about needing to get kids pushing back to college and also talk about the crisis in student loan debt at the same time. You're going to be pushing kids to take on lots of debt to major in something that isn't going to have the return to pay back that debt.
Something else that's unclear to me that is highlighted in this editorial is, yes, they're talking about the decline of students that opted against going to college. And one of the statistics that's never available in these stories is how many people deferred enrollment. So that they're not saying, I'm not going. They're saying, I don't want my first year of college to be this remote Zoom learning year that they're currently having. And look, there are a lot of problems that are going to come from that, because if you're a university, particularly if you're a smaller university like my alma mater, enrollment of all of about 2,300. Small universities like that, you accept more students than will actually enroll, because you know you're only going to get a percentage of the people you accept who are actually going to enroll at the university. And you have a capacity. There is only so many people who can be on campus. There's only so many people who they have housing available for at Little Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, where I went. And there's, I assume, all kinds of calculations they've made for this is how many people we need to accept to get this many people enrolled at this rate of scholarship with this much coming in tuition money. I assume that there is a worked out formula for all of that. And if in 1 year you have a bunch of people who say, yeah, I don't want my experience to be like that. I'm just going to defer enrollment, hope things get back to normal by next fall. And they seem to be on track with the vaccine and everything to be on back to normal. Well, now they're in the position of the next class, well, they can only admit so many people because the people they admitted for the previous class are all going to be showing up. So we don't even know how many of these people that the Sun-Times is so concerned about not going to college are actually going to not go.
Right. And that's a great point. And I sympathize with people who are either, I mean, all college students, but either starting college or ending college right now and had this weird year. I try to put myself in their shoes and think about what I would have done if I would have tried to take a year or a semester off. I just would have sucked it up and did a lot of Zoom learning, which would have been a very diluted experience and I'm not really sure worthwhile for the cost of it. So I sympathize with that. But all these problems that you just mentioned would come of deferring enrollment that the university, I mean, this is weird for them too. It's not just weird for the students, weird for the university and for educators, how they're handling this whole thing. I don't think just having more kids go back to school if they deferred enrollment or if they're considering going to school from just changing paths is the answer to fix any of that. I think it's a lot more complicated than, I mean, the enrollment thing you just mentioned, I think most people don't even consider that issue.
Yeah. I think something else that the push for kids to go to college does bother me to a certain extent, but not as much as the push for them to go immediately out of high school.
Sure. No one's saying you have to do
that. What 18-year-old knows exactly what, and you're supposed to set this path for yourself and choose a major and focus on this. What 18-year-old really understands that? I mean, I have a degree that I do not really use. I have a degree in music business, Joe. I have a degree in music business and I work in marketing. You don't know at that point in time. And look, I'm grateful for the degree that I got and the experience that I had. But it would be better, I think, for more 18-year-olds coming out of high school to take a year and actually work a job, do something, find an internship if that's the kind of thing. Find the thing you're interested in. Go spend some time doing it. Find a place that will let you do some of it. Figure out if that's what you're really interested in, and then reconsider the college question.
Growth isn't linear. It's everyone has a different path and different steps they take to find what they really want to do. And maybe it works out for you where you major in accounting or engineering or something, and you think about that at 18, you end up having a very successful and enjoyable career in that. But a lot of 18-year-olds are dumb or naive or just trying to figure things out. And if not delaying going to college, because you can do it. You can go at 19, you can go at 20, you can go whenever.
Yeah.
If not delaying it, there should at least be something maybe at the end of high school or at the start of college in your freshman year where you explore different career paths. Some people have a better idea than others, but growth is not linear. It's not the same for everybody. You're 18, you're impressionable. I think there should be more of an emphasis on trying to figure that out, whether that's in high school or college or some kind of, you mentioned internship, something in between high school and college where you just learn more about different professions.
Yes. I think that experience would be more valuable. And Milton Friedman, the great economist, has said that, you know, college for far too many has turned into a pleasant four-year interlude in between high school and real life. And if you're actually prepping for something, like you want to be a doctor and you need that first 4 years of pre-med, that's one thing. But again, I learned marketing by doing it, not by having a degree in music business. The demonstration of the ability to apply oneself, that all makes sense. But I think we really need to reconsider this. And just this push from the Chicago Sun-Times that we just need to get things back to the way that they were serves the interest of the universities. But I don't know how that it really serves the interest of the students. Mark, hang on line one. We'll get to you after the break. Anybody else wants to join us on the program? 312-642-5600 to join us on the program today, or you can text your message, text your DA and your message to 646-36. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy. Give us a call, 312-642-5600. To join us on the program today. Let's go to line one and Mark in Plainfield. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Eric and Joe. Interesting topic. I have a 16-year-old son who's a junior in high school right now. He's going through this issue. What do I want to major in? And, you know, college and all that. And while I was listening to you guys discuss it, a question popped into my mind. You know, is there any adverse effects to a child taking a gap year? You know, like, is it tougher to get into a top-tier college like Champaign, or do some of the scholarships get harder to get? And, you know, it's a lot of money to go into when you're going in on the side. And what are the adverse effects of a gap year? My solution to my son was, if you don't know what to do, go in the military, because, you know, they'll teach you stuff you will not learn anywhere else.
And yep.
I also think in this post-COVID era, you want to be on the side of the with the people with the guns. So I'm pushing the Air Force on them. And other comment I had on this issue is, if colleges are really worried about enrollment, then the law of supply and demand says lower your prices. It's ridiculous what these people are charging. And,
You're not wrong, Mark. I mean, the cost that you're talking about, and thanks so much, Mark, for the call, the cost associated with it, it should remind you that it doesn't respond to the laws of supply and demand, because the whole thing is really just a government-orchestrated scheme. The fact that the government is the lender of first and last resort in almost all cases now is what helps fuel the ridiculous tuition prices and the continuing inflation of tuition over time.
Yeah, and on Mark's first point, too, about the gap year, I mean, I don't know.
I'm unaware of any problems like that. But the other thing you can do is do what a lot of people have done as a result of the pandemic, which is go ahead and apply. And you can defer your enrollment, I believe, for up to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if at the end you don't want to go, you don't have to go. But it at least allows you to get in and then go do your thing for a while and figure out what makes sense for you.
Right. Yeah. I don't know of any problems with it either. And you and I both went to college at 18 right out of high school. But I think I would treat it like a gap on a job resume. It's you explain what the gap is.
Right.
And you can use that gap to do something pretty useful.
Yes. And it's not as if colleges aren't familiar with the idea of people taking a gap year in between high school and college. Let's go to line two and Liddy in Munster, Indiana. Liddy, good morning.
Good morning. I am retired as a high school guidance counselor. In all the conversations about college, very seldom do I hear any reference to community college and use the term post-secondary education instead of college, because in Indiana we have Ivy Tech. You have many in community colleges in Illinois. There are technical, or what I call terminal diplomas.
Mm-hmm.
There's the transfer, but that is never discussed. We always consider the 4 years.
Yep. No, that's Lydia, it's a great point. I mean, community colleges are an incredible resource, and more people should access them if that's the kind of training that they're looking for, and that's valuable training. Let's go real quick. Line three, Eddie in Midway. Eddie, real fast.
Yeah, I went to Jones Commercial my senior year, and I did school in the morning and Harris Bank wire transferring in the afternoon. I will say another thing that parents need to do, they need to limit their son and daughter to one sport only. So that way they can maybe possibly do something else, like working after school.
Yeah. Good point, Eddie. Thank you for the call. Let's go to line four and Tony in Downers Grove. Real quick, Tony.
Real quick. I think it's a complex subject, and you can't forget that, you know, companies still hire people that they require them to have four-year degrees in a lot of cases. So that hasn't changed. Either has making connections, and either has people with more money going to Ivy League schools who come out with the same types of liberal degrees, and they get better jobs because they went to those higher-paying educations. So
thanks for the call, Tony. We got to run. But, look, there are advantages for schooling like that. People should weigh those considerations closely.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Ohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. We talked earlier in the program a little bit about social media and the effect that it has on all of us. Much consternation about social media in general, about Facebook specifically, about Google. One of the things that is going on is that the FTC has filed a lawsuit, a antitrust action against Facebook. That's one thing that's proceeding. I think other states have as well. There's been a lot of conversation about Google as well in an antitrust sense. There's been a lot of conversation about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which affects all of them. And a lot of that, especially the antitrust part of it, can be very difficult to make sense of. So when I have a difficulty making sense of things, I talk to people who are smarter than me, which is often doesn't narrow it down a whole lot.
Yeah, so just pick somebody.
Just somebody off the street in almost any case would work. But in this case, we actually have someone who really knows what he's talking about, which is fantastic. And that is Will Reinhardt, who is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State. Will, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So my lead question in all of this is the case that is being filed against Facebook. What is it that they believe Facebook has a monopoly on?
Yeah, they think that Facebook has a monopoly on basically personal social media market. It's a really weird and kind of niche little market, to be very, frank. Because the thing is that there's a whole bunch of competitors that they don't include in this market. So, you know, LinkedIn is effectively not a competitor to Facebook, which I don't think is completely correct. But yeah, they're basically saying that effectively Facebook has a monopoly in this personal social media market. And they're going after the company and their mergers, or rather their acquisitions of WhatsApp and Instagram. The FTC are saying that both of those acquisitions were efforts to basically kind of, you know, lock up this market.
Which, again, to me, does not seem to make a lot of sense. And this was kind of elucidated to me by seeing Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who was making a similar complaint about Facebook being a monopoly and making this analogy to it being like, you know, a grocery store, but it's the only grocery store in town and they can decide whether or not you can shop there. And he was making this argument on Twitter, which seemed a little odd to me to not recognize the obviousness of that's another grocery store, bro.
Yeah. And this is exactly the question is, you know, is Facebook this? I mean, obviously, Facebook is a very important source and a very important site that a lot of people are on. But then the question becomes, are there, you know, challengers? Are there competitors to Facebook where people can get out their voice? And I think that's exactly correct. You know, you have Twitter. You also have, you know, up and coming now, you have a lot of newsletters. You have you still have, you know, Reddit, which would be, I think, also a substitution. And then you have obviously increasingly TikTok, which I think is this other place where especially younger individuals are going for, you know, content and for media and to connect with individuals. And all these things are not included in the case, the FTC case against Facebook, which seems to me to be kind of it seems to be an oversight, to be very blunt.
Right. Yeah, totally. But just thinking all things considered, what do you see as the merits of the case? We've obviously outlined a lot of problems with it, but what are the merits that could play in its favor going forward, legally speaking?
Yeah, I mean, so it really matters a lot how the courts will want to kind of rule against Facebook. And so to be very clear, there are obviously very clear merits to this. There is something to be said that Facebook does have probably pretty massive power in the space of social media, despite the fact that, you know, that there are competitors. But the real question and the thing that we're going to have to deal with all of these cases, and there's a whole bunch of them coming down, is that especially for social media, none of these cases have really been tried before in the United States. And so this idea of, you know, what is the correct market definition, that's going to be a really, really big thing that the courts are going to have to deal with. And then also this thing that we've kind of talked about, or at least has been mentioned in commentary over this, is that effectively Facebook and Google are non-priced goods. You know, you don't pay anything to use Google or Facebook. And that is actually going to be, I think, a pretty big hurdle. So there are some very clear, you know, some very clear positives to these cases in the sense that, you know, they're kind of going after these companies and they're trying to figure out what might stick. And they're kind of throwing everything against these companies, both Facebook and Google. But I think that you're going to find and I'm going to find that it's actually a lot more difficult to bring these cases. And it's going to be kind of interesting to watch this as it happens over the next at least 3 years.
Will, what is the theory on the benefit to consumers, to social media users, if WhatsApp and Instagram were not part of the Facebook Borg? In what way do they think that this makes things better for consumers?
Yeah, this is actually going to be the really tough question, and I think you've highlighted exactly what the courts are going to have to decide is whether or not the Instagram, particularly the Instagram acquisition, really would Instagram have been a competitor to Facebook if it were not merged with Facebook, you know, back in 2013. And so that question is really going to be driving this analysis, which is that, you know, if Instagram were not merged and if Instagram didn't have the kind of the resources from Facebook, to be very honest, would that company have grown to compete with Facebook and taken over some of the market share and therefore, you know, kind of changed kind of the competitive landscape? And this, again, is kind of difficult to really tease out, and it's going to be really difficult for the district courts to deal with, because, you know, it's really hard to say what would have happened if this merger hadn't occurred. But just as important, you know, there is this question of whether or not, you know, Instagram itself would have even been, you know, if it would have been bought by somebody else, or also just primarily would consumers have flocked to Instagram had it not been for the kinds of, you know, resources and engineering power that was put into the site and really revamped it after Facebook acquired it in 2013.
The other thing I have a difficult time wrapping my head around is even let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that Facebook has a monopoly in the realm of social media. We're not talking about a monopoly in steel. We're not talking about a monopoly in chicken. We're not talking about a monopoly in things that are really essential to our daily lives. It's something that a lot of people are now leaving of their own accord because they just don't want to be a part of it anymore. Like, how meaningful is it even if they have a monopoly?
Yeah, that's something that sometimes the courts deal with, but they haven't really... Typically, the law doesn't really care all that much about the, you know, how important these things are. So, you know, one of the biggest court cases as it relates to antitrust is actually a case about ski lifts. So, you know, interestingly enough, it doesn't, at least the courts don't really care all about that too much. It's just as long as there's a good case that's being brought, the courts will determine one way or another. And I'm pretty confident the fact that you know, there has been a lot of development in the last, you know, 40 years in this space in antitrust, but the courts are kind of skeptical of bringing these sorts of cases. And I, you know, the Facebook case, to be very honest, I think is the toughest of all these cases. There is one of the Google cases, which I think is a little easier. And I think the other big ones we're going to be waiting for will be the Apple and Amazon cases, which we know are kind of coming in the next couple months. And those two, I think, are going to be the real ones to watch, because I think that despite all of the problems you're going to have, I think it's going to be a little bit easier to actually bring those cases in the current court system.
Can you break down real quick why the Apple and Amazon ones are easier to move ahead?
Yeah, the reason why it's a little easier to bring those is just because we have a little bit more. It feels like much more of a standard case. So with the Amazon case, what they're really looking for, or at least what it seems that they're probably going to go after, is the fact that Amazon seems to have pricing power, or seems to maybe have power over, you know, the sellers, the third party sellers on its platform. And so that sort of case is actually there's actually a lot of really, really good law behind that case. Similarly, something kind of similar is happening with Apple, but Apple again is a priced good. You know, there is actually prices that are involved in Apple's iTunes store and kind of all of the app store. And that's probably also where that will probably focus on. And so all those things just mean that at the end of the day, that because there's prices, we can actually see the consumer effects much, much easier. But when we go to the social media space, and especially like the search space, and as I said, the social media space, because we just don't have prices, it makes all of the analysis just all that much more complex.
Well, let's turn to Google then real quick, because as I'm trying to think about these things, the argument that Google has a monopoly on search seems to make a lot more sense to me than the suggestion of Facebook having a monopoly in social media.
You don't ask Jeeves?
Yeah. Well, this is in part my point that we've adopted Google as the term for when you search something.
Yeah,
you don't search
now.
It, you Google it.
Yeah,
they have really dominated that space. But I was It's funny, I was kind of reminded of why you mentioned the ski lift case, which I'm not familiar with. But when I think of antitrust, I think of Microsoft and the Microsoft Internet Explorer being the default browser. I helped set up a Windows computer for someone, and Microsoft Edge is the new browser. And the first thing I did when I opened Edge was typed in Google Chrome. And I wonder how many of those, even if it's the default one installed, how many people went to something else other than that. So to bring it back around, do you think that there is a more solid case against Google, at least in the sense that, you know, set aside, you know, that it's not a priced good, that they really do seem to overwhelm search out there?
Yeah. So the cases, there's actually at least three cases right now that I'm following. And these are probably going to be the three major cases. So the one brought by the DOJ really does look at some of this part of the search industry, but there is a one that I'm actually following pretty closely, which is led by Texas and some of the Republican state AGs, that effectively is going after Google's advertising practices. And again, I think that that's probably going to be all of these cases. There's, like I said, there's three cases. These are all probably going to be merged within the courts. But the Texas led one, the advertising one, I think is probably the strongest one that exists so far of all of the cases that have been brought. Again, just because there is much clearer harms, or at least much clearer purported harms with Google's advertising practices as compared to something that we may say with search. Because as I suggested, or at least I think that you're really trying to hint at with Google, is that, you know, we do use Google pretty you know, consistently whenever we're going for search. But then there's this other really interesting question, which is that, well, is Google competitive on search? But what kind of search? Is it really all search? Well, you know, not all search actually nets an advertising or an advertisement. And so when you're actually looking at the things that Google actually cares a lot about and the things that it spends a lot of money on, you know, especially in the advertising space, it really is in this, what you might think of competitive search or, you know, product search. And that is it's a little bit more, the market isn't as clearly trending towards Google as everyone might think. In particular, Amazon, it really is the biggest competitor here, because just as much as people go to search for Google for products, they go to Amazon to search for products. And so that will be the other sort of analysis, or at least will probably be the analysis that the courts and that the DOJ and the state AGs are going to have to deal with as well, which is that consumers use a whole bunch of different platforms in order to make search queries, but it's a very specific niche within the search queries that actually are the most important competitive things for these major platforms.
Will, final question for you. How long does it usually take to get some kind of a resolution in cases like this? If my memory serves, the Microsoft antitrust case took quite a while to get resolved. And given the dynamic nature of the tech space and the internet space, I mean, one of these companies could be knocked off their pedestal by the time they might even get to a resolution, maybe.
Yeah, so the Microsoft case took almost a decade to kind of resolve itself. And I think that we'll probably expect, you know, the earliest that these cases are going to come, the first DOJ case was brought against Google in October, and they're saying now they're looking towards the end part of 2023 as the earliest set date for the beginning of the court cases. So we're looking for at least 5 years. I'm expecting probably this entire decade is going to be is really going to be filled with these court cases. So no time soon. Probably the earliest resolution will be probably in 2030, to be very honest.
Well, then by that point, we'll all have been taken over by TikTok in China. So what will it matter anyway? We'll
exactly,
all be just doing silly
exactly.
dances and just kind of dance our cares away. Will Reinhart is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State. Will, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Joe, I made a mistake. I forgot to ask Will a very important question, which is, I follow Will on Twitter, and there was this thing going yesterday, one of these viral-ish things that I guess Twitter has a monopoly on and probably should get sued over, I don't know. In five words or less, start a fight without politics. And First of all, the correct response to that is five words or fewer.
Right.
That's the way to start a fight about it.
And that is good. Yeah, that's a great way to start a fight.
But Will's was Chicago has the best pizza.
Which is where we are.
Which is where we are. And I neglected to clarify from him whether he meant deep dish or tavern cut. Because this is important.
Well, I'm assuming since he's not from Chicago, or at least he doesn't live in Chicago.
He's a Utah boy.
That he meant deep dish because more often than not, if you're some other part of the country and you're referring to Chicago pizza, you're thinking of deep dish,
mm-hmm.
which is not how Chicagoans
which is, yes,
think of
which
pizza.
Is a mistake. My standard analogy on this is deep dish pizza is like the Statue of Liberty or Navy Pier. It's something you do when family comes in from out of town. You know, you go to Giordano's, you go to Lou Malnati's, you go to Pequod's, you do the deep dish pizza. But if you're a Chicagoan and you're just getting pizza for dinner, you're probably getting the thin crust tavern style pizza.
Yes.
And that is the one for which you can make an argument that Chicago has the best pizza.
Well, now here's, and you can, but I'm going to, this pains me to say this, and I think I've said this to you either on our show or in private before, and I'm very proud to be from here. I don't really care for the city of New York or people from New York necessarily, but I will say I do think New York has the best pizza. I mean, I've never been to New Haven, Connecticut, which is...
I hear incredible things about New Haven-style pizza.
Yeah.
Never been there, never had it. Really want to try it, though.
It's claimed to be the pizza capital of the world. Just going to the New York-Chicago thing, I love pizza in New York. Absolutely love it.
The availability of plenty of places in New York, no matter where you are, where you can walk in and just get a slice of pizza, you do the fold thing, you eat it right there. To me, you can't beat that. But in second place to me is your Chicago Southside
sure.
tavern-style pizza. It's a solid second place. And the one thing we should all be able to agree on is that St. Louis-style pizza is a war crime.
I think we should agree that it's not pizza. I think we should, war crime's fine, but let's not even say St. Louis-style pizza. Let's add crackers,
let's just say
cheese and crackers.
Cheese and crackers with some tomato paste.
It's an abomination to cheese and crackers, because I like a little some cheddar on a Ritz cracker, and that's much better than that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Together, we host Sources with Knowledge, heard here on the weekends on News Talk 560, The Answer, Saturday mornings at 8 and Sundays again at 3 p.m. Want you to be a part of the program with us today. To do that, give us a call at 312-642-5600, or you can text your message, DA, and your message to 64636. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to James Fitzgerald, who is a retired FBI special agent and criminal profiler, about the Christmas Day Nashville bombing. But for now, I want to talk about one of the things that is going to change with the Biden administration coming in is going to be foreign policy. And we want to know how that is going to change under a Biden administration. And to find out, we're going to talk with Jonathan Greenberg, who is a senior fellow at the Chaim Solomon Center and a writer on foreign policy and national security issues, focusing on the Middle East and America's role in the world. He has already called top bunk at whatever gulag the Biden administration sends him to. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us. Can I bunk with you? Us Cones and Greenbergs usually have stuck together and things like that.
That's yes. In case you're mistakenly sent to the same gulag I sent to, you're welcome to bottom bunk.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So before we get into the changes with in what foreign policy will look like under a Biden administration, after 4 years of the Trump administration, how do you assess the state of American foreign policy after 4 years of President Donald Trump?
So I think that the Trump administration did actually a lot right in this area, but I think it was incomplete. You know, as with a lot of things that the Trump administration got right, I think some of it was done right by mistake. Very little of it was planned. I think that the outgoing president has some really good gut instincts about these things, but not a lot of success at institutionalizing them. So, for example, you know, skepticism about international institutions that come out of a post-World War II liberal international order, you know, reassessing those in the light of victory in the Cold War. We never reassessed our relationship with NATO. We never reassessed the United Nations after we won the Cold War, and never. And, you know, George H.W. Bush talked about it, but we never really reassessed whether those institutions were necessary. We just kind of kept on going because there was an accepted way of doing things. And the only way that you could get a job in the State Department was to accept that way of doing things. So there's been this groupthink for the last 25 years in foreign policy that has served our country, I think, really badly. And the Trump administration came in and said, well, forget that. We're just going to look at what we think makes sense, which I think is was a really refreshing way of doing things.
Would you say that the Abraham Accords, whether you want to give direct credit or indirect credit to the Trump administration, I mean, is this really the best example of the example of the best of Trump's foreign policy changes?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that was the ground for that has been prepared by the Israelis and the countries that they've made peace with for a long time. There's been a lot of, you know, back channel negotiation and discussion and relationship building. But the Trump administration came in and said, you know, our friends are our friends, and their enemies are not people that we should be in bed with. We should be supporting sister democracies like Israel. And cutting off the Palestinians, cutting off the United Nations when they beat up on Israel for no good reason, that message was sent loudly and clearly, and you know that we were essentially open for a new way of thinking about our relationships with other countries. And without that rethinking, I really don't believe that the Abraham Accords would have come to fruition.
Are you expecting, with the incoming Biden administration, and as we look at a lot of the people being appointed in a Biden administration, it very much looks like the third term of Barack Obama. I mean, these aren't foreign policy appointments, but, you know, you have Tom Vilsack in the same job he had in the Obama administration. Are you expecting just basically a return to the way that we looked at the world 4 years ago?
No, I think it's worse than that. I think we're going to be returning. It's the third term of the Clinton administration. We're going to be, you know, the Obama administration was characterized, their foreign policy was characterized by a lot of naivete. And I think the Biden administration foreign policy will be governed by the same naivete. But theirs was like an activist naivete. I don't think we're going to have the same thing in the Biden administration. We're going to go back to the 90s. And, you know, this belief that the world is essentially post Cold War again. The most important things are our alliances and the institutions that those alliances form, and that we need to guard the alliances for the sake of the alliance, not for the sake of any particular nation's interest. So we're going to go from the jingoism of America first to something more like America when Sweden says it's okay.
So apply that to some real current situations, because you mentioned a lot of President Trump's work in foreign policy you would consider incomplete. So the hand that Biden's been given, how do you think he'd handle some current ongoing situations?
Yeah, my biggest concern, I think there are three real flashpoints in the world in the coming, you know, 10 years or so, for the United States, I mean. And the first one is, I think, and probably the most important one that I'm not an expert in, but I think is really important, is China. China is a rising power. China is becoming a global hegemon. They're able now to project their strength far more globally than they were before, and that's only going to get better for them. And they're an oppressive, abusive communist regime that throws people in concentration camps. Their ability to project, global, I don't know what you even call it, authoritarianism, is terrifying and should terrify Americans. And we don't talk about it enough. Their ability to get away with murder, literally on the international stage, to lie and deceive the world into, the pandemic that we have now and get away with it scot-free because they own whole institutions, including American cultural institutions like Hollywood, like the NBA. Their ability to get away with that is really unprecedented, and Americans don't seem to care. So, and I don't see the Biden administration doing anything to halt or even slow that down. I think another flashpoint for us is going to be the Mexican border. Mexico is terrifyingly close to being a failed narco state, and the violence on our southern border and is likely to get significantly worse. Again, this is not an area of my foreign policy expertise, but it's something that I see and that really worries me coming up in the next 10 or 20 years. And I don't see the Biden administration doing anything to stop that, for partly because of their own naivete and partly because the political coalition they have won't let them. So, you know, those are things that, you know, again, we talk about Trump, the incomplete Trump foreign policy. This is something where Trump's rhetoric was always way too over the top, irresponsible. But the policy at the heart of it wasn't entirely wrong and was at least trying to address the problem as it actually exists.
Well, one of the approaches of President Trump in all of this was a greater skepticism of foreign involvement, foreign entanglement, foreign conflict than previous administrations, and may seem to make an effort to get us, you know, we've been in 2021, we've been in Afghanistan for 20 years and wanted to bring us back from that. Do you think that is something that is going to be reinvested in under a Biden administration? Because it strikes me that that was the most justifiable of the two wars that started shortly after 9/11, Afghanistan and Iraq. But nobody really seems to understand what we're doing there. And I've said for years now, if someone can articulate clearly to me what victory looks like in a meaningful way in Afghanistan, I might change my mind about saying we should get out of there. What are you expecting the Biden administration's approach to that particular conflict to be?
I don't think that there will be a reinvestment in Afghanistan. I think everybody recognizes that, as you say, we've reached a point where there's not a lot more that we can do except keep boys there getting killed. But that said, how we leave matters greatly. And, you know, turning the keys directly back over to the Taliban means that the 20 years of sacrifice we've had is essentially meaningless. And so how we leave, I think, matters. And I would say that I can count on the Biden administration to do what the Obama administration did in Iraq, which is to leave irresponsibly, leave a vacuum that the Taliban is likely to fill, and the ISIS filled in Western Iraq and in Syria. And I think then devastation will probably follow. So as in terms of Afghanistan, but there is a lot of other Obama era stuff that Trump tried to undo that you can see the Biden administration already intending to reinvest in. The Iran nuclear deal is a perfect example. Jake Sullivan, who was one of the architects of the early portions of the deal, is the national security advisor in the Biden administration. So you can bet they're going to be reinvesting in that. The difference is, this is a really important difference, Eric. The reason I say we're going back to Clinton and not to Obama, we're going to be prosecuting foreign policy again through the machinery of the state. Whereas the Obama administration, with Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor for spin and gaslighting, I don't really know what his title was, but it was something akin to that. Without Ben Rhodes or a Ben Rhodes type in the national security apparatus, we won't be prosecuting American foreign policy through the press and for show, which is so much of what the Obama administration did. Biden, at least, is an institutionalist. I think that's better. It's only marginally better, but it is better.
I was going to say, you might have kind of hit on this a little bit. I think a lot of Trump rhetorically, although some of it was irresponsible, his skepticism of entanglements in Afghanistan and Iraq and just being involved in a lot of different conflicts around the world, public sentiment was on his side. So I'm wondering how Biden navigates moving off that, if he does move off that, how he handles things rhetorically when people are skeptical of why we've been in the Middle East for so long, how Biden at least rhetorically moves past the Trump administration's approach to that.
Yeah, this gets me to one of the things that I'm saddest about, which is a general lack of seriousness about foreign policy in the American electorate. I think that any administration can do much of what it wants to do. I don't think you can easily entangle us in a new war, but I think that you can do pretty much whatever you want in the area of foreign policy because American voters just don't care. They don't pay attention to it. They don't think seriously about it. It doesn't affect directly their pocketbook. And, you know, we've largely got now this, this, you know, group of people who are soldiers and their kids become soldiers. And, you know, and if you, the average American isn't touched in any real way by our foreign entanglement, which is too bad. It's a real shame. We don't ask serious questions during campaigns. We don't demand serious answers during campaigns. So I think largely how you move the public is you count on them not to care, and they seldom let you down.
How do you – final question for you, Jonathan. How would you think about going about trying to change that, though? I mean, I think the end of the Cold War created a lot of circumstances that we're still working through, and I think there's an instinct in the American people that we would rather be like the global – like the predominant superpower rather than China, but we also lack an appetite for the kind of projection of that power because we've seen the cost of it over the last 20 years. Like, how do you even go about making an argument to change that in people's minds?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, people have to understand why this stuff matters. People have to understand why China's ascendancy matters directly for Americans. We do a terrible job of explaining that. Politicians do a terrible job of speaking to it, and our cultural institutions are captured by financial interests in China. I mean, just the, you know, I mentioned the NBA earlier, and you know, you can say, well, it's just the NBA, who really cares? But that's a major cultural institution in the United States. And when you can put any ridiculous phrase you want on the back of your Memphis Grizzlies jersey, but you can't put Free Hong Kong, that's a big deal. And, you know, we fail to notice these things at our own peril.
He is Jonathan Greenberg, senior fellow at the Chaim Solomon Center, a writer on foreign policy and national security issues, and my future bunkmate in the gulag that the Biden administration sends us both to. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us this morning. See you in the gulag.
Thanks, guys.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com. /mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Be a part of the program with us at 312-642-5600. That's 312-642-5600. Or you can text DA and your message to 64636. I enjoy talking to Jonathan. I agree with him. The foreign policy is just one of these areas that we don't want to think about. My own personal thinking on a lot of these things has changed over the years. I used to be I never liked the term isolationist, and I think that is used often as a pejorative against people who are more skeptical of foreign involvement and wish the United States wouldn't be as involved as it was over the last 20 years in a whole lot of other places. But I agree with him, and I think it's a problem that we don't think about these things. Voters tend not to think about these things. They're a backseat priority when they do. And I think it will be interesting to see over the coming years if China replaces that role that the Soviet Union occupied for so long in the Cold War, if we're actually entering another Cold War with them. There's just a whole lot in that area that I think is yet to be sorted out.
For sure. I mean, and it's I think in the last couple of years, at least some – I know I agree with what Jonathan's point about, you know, a lot of people not following it, but at least there's been some increase in a skeptical eye toward China. Maybe that's just with people who are already kind of following foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely going to be something to look forward to, not to change the earlier optimistic tone about the world that we had on the show half ago.
There are challenges in the world, and there are always going to be challenges in the world. I think we are going to get more hawkish on China. The question is, are we going to be smart about it, or are we going to be dumb about it? My fear, and I think Jonathan would probably agree with this, my fear is that we're going to be dumb about it. And that will create its own problems. That has the potential to make things a lot worse and not better. And I can only hope, then I just don't have a lot of optimism that the Biden administration is going to be smart about this. I just don't know where that optimism would come from.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. The big story from over the weekend was on Christmas, a bomb exploded on 2nd Street in Nashville, Tennessee. If you've seen the pictures, you hear there was an explosion, and it's always the way these stories roll out, and then you see the destruction, the devastation that happened from that explosion. I know some people in Nashville. It affected an AT&T data center. People were without cell phone connectivity for more than a day. Still trying to figure out what all happened here.
It's just eerie. If you've watched the video, it's not just a typical, you know, attack. It was just very eerie. The countdown, the voice, everything about it, the calls to
playing
evacuate.
The song Downtown before it went off. It
was something you had to script.
Yeah, that was my first thought. It's like it sounds like something out of a sequel to The Dark Knight with the Joker again. And it's a hard thing for us to make sense of. So we're going to talk to somebody who knows how to make sense of these things. James Fitzgerald is a retired FBI supervisory special agent, criminal profiler, and forensic linguist, former member of the Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI. He worked on the manhunt for the Unabomber case and is the author of a series of books, A Journey to the Center of the Mind. James, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Eric and Joe, and a belated Merry Christmas to you and your listeners out there.
Merry Christmas to you too, James. So I guess the simplest way to ask the question to start is, like, what at this point do we know? And those particularly bizarre circumstances that Joe and I just mentioned, the countdown, the song playing before the bomb went off. What are we to make of any of this?
Sure. You mentioned, the old Batman movie or something. I was thinking of going back farther at the Twilight Zone or even more currently Black Mirror, some kind of dystopian sort of enactment playing out here. Yeah, as soon as I woke up Christmas morning and heard this, I said, boy, this is an odd one. And, with my experience, my background in working these types of cases in the FBI over the years, even some since then, at least following through the media, I thought, all right, Islamist terrorist attack Christmas morning. But that was the only tie-in to it. The highest, holy day of the Christian calendar is Christmas, of course. But then all of a sudden, wait, Nashville? In a kind of uncrowded downtown area at, I think it finally detonated at 6:30 or so, but these bizarre warnings going out, and of all songs, Downtown by Petula Clark.
Yeah.
What's up with that? That helped me kind of age the offender, and I got away from international terrorists to somebody probably a grievance collector or injustice collector. There's somebody who sees injustices in most of the things that happen to them in life. Even small sites or, every misfortune that has befallen them is, they know who to blame. And then I started leaning in more in that direction. And if there's any motivation I can share with you and your listeners now, this guy, he probably has a lot of anger and vitriol against a person, place, or thing. I can't tell you what it is yet. And it may go back 2 weeks. It may go back 2 months. It could go back 2 decades. Because obviously this guy is up there, 63. I never say these guys' names on the air, whether they're shooters or,
sure,
or bombers, whatever. But we'll call him the Nashville bomber. And I was thinking at first he was very sophisticated to drive this RV in, and perhaps he could have scrubbed all the information off of the vehicle identification number, the tag, and there'd be no way to track him down. Or he's very unsophisticated in terms of being identified. Now, by saying that, I'm not taking away from the construction of his IED, his improvised explosive device. Clearly, it succeeded in blowing up. It succeeded in damaging a lot of property, injuring at least 3 people. And I do want to say up front, kudos to the police officers on the scene who evacuated a good number of people. I believe at least one or more of those were among the wounded. So again, with all the battering the police have taken this year, once again they're out there saving lives and putting others out of harm's way. So a bizarre case. It's different than anyone. Bombers are always, quite frankly, unique. They have their own different personalities than other violent or serial offenders. They don't do crimes usually for money, for greed.
for sexual gratification, meaning the bombings themselves. He may have had hang-ups in that regard, but, you know, usually that's not the overall motivation behind what they're doing. So there's just a summary of what I saw from this so far. The law enforcement, FBI, are going to do a not only a physical autopsy of the remains of the body, but also what is known as a psychological autopsy. And that is, well, they will break down this person's life over the last, quite frankly, probably his whole life, but certainly the last few years, from every email he sent, every phone call he's made, every type of writing or journal or diary he may have kept. And they're going to try to finally put together the pieces of what the motivation may be behind this incident on Christmas morning.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because obviously there's a lot we still need to learn. But you said, you know, he clearly had some sort of grievance against a person, place, or thing. How do, in a case like this, when you're trying to break it down and get to the bottom of it, without directly asking the guy, how do you analyze and determine motive? How do you start to understand that without getting to the, I mean, investigating him directly, but how do you start to take different pieces from the case and put together a motive and try to understand that?
Well, sure. And even if the offender in a case such as this, or any case, was still alive, he or she would have legal representation. And of course, they would say, no, don't talk to law enforcement. So really, it's the same principle here. They can almost look at it as like, you know, the defendant is not talking. The arrested individual refuses, you know, he has not waived his Miranda warning. So the police and FBI have to build a case around him. And that's exactly what is going on here. Now, I also don't want to rule out the fact that they found remains in the trailer or the RV or at the scene, including that of his dog. I would be cautious not to lock in that, in fact, that is our bomber. And I'm not saying anything other than the possibility can't be ruled out that a body was already in the car. Somebody else drove it in and back and then got out somehow and did their thing. So even though they think they have their person of interest, meaning the FBI and law enforcement, they're going to be looking at all different angles in terms of who exactly was in that car. Now, they use DNA, I keep saying car, but the RV, they use DNA to match it up to a certain individual, and that seems to be pretty consistent right now. But they're certainly going to look at other co-conspirators or other people that may be behind this, supplied him with materials, the power source, the wiring, the explosive material, the detonator, all those types of things that are involved in looking at these types of bombings. And they're also going to be, these guys always do practice bombing. They have to make sure their device is going to work. So they're going to do research and find that somewhere in the woods and the Smoky Mountains or somewhere near, within 100 miles or two of where this person lived, they're going to find other sites that this guy went and, you know, tested his device to make sure it would, in fact, go off, and he wouldn't have given his warning and played the Petula Clark song, and it would have been, for no reason there. So he had to make sure it worked. So these are all the things we're going to look at. Who saw him back then? Did he drive the RV to these locations? Did he drive some other vehicle? All these factors are going to be taken into account, and let's hope we get some sort of an outcome. Because remember from the Las Vegas shooter in 2017, there's never been a motivation found, or at least not one released by the task force who was examining it. That always bothered me.
Yeah.
That you're telling me you found nothing about this guy. This guy was a blank slate, supposedly, from a social media perspective or any friends. He had a girlfriend, I think, I don't know, the Philippines or somewhere, but she really could offer no information. So I'm hoping we can at least get a motivation out of or determine a motivation from this guy, unlike the Las Vegas shooting. But just let me add here, too. It's interesting, the last few years, we've had some older guys committing these crimes. It's usually been younger offenders, either serial offenders or one-off, like apparently is this guy. But we had the Nova Scotia shooter just back in April. He was 51. The Las Vegas shooter was 64. Kaczynski, the Unabomber, was in his 50s, and he was still active, early 50s. And now we have this guy at 63. So what was the sort of province of younger men in the past for these types of violent crimes? We're finding older guys, for whatever reason, coming out of retirement or just finally, you know, releasing these demons that have been building up for decades, perhaps, and they're doing what they do. And it even is more mystifying sometimes. Like, you reach that stage in life, kind of retirement age, mm-hmm. You feel you have to go out with a bang, literally, in this case.
and take other people with you, conceivably, luckily not in this case. So, yeah, there's some strange things, and I'll be very curious. This guy is, he's an outlier among outliers, and I'll be very curious to hear when everything is put together, all the puzzle pieces, just what made him do what he did.
The if the answer to this question is that you can't speculate on these things, I totally understand. But one of the things that popped into my mind with the 15-minute warning being played over a loudspeaker and telling people to evacuate, it would suggest to me that if you were trying to kill as many people as possible, you're not going to play a warning like that. Does that suggest that I've heard some speculation from the news sources that the AT&T data center that caused the disruption in cell phone coverage in the area might have been the target of this. Does the warning suggest to you that it was possibly, you know, you mentioned a person, place, or thing, that it was less about a person and probably maybe more about a thing? Can we read that into it, or is it just impossible to tell that at this point?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll give you the best answer I can. IEDs, again, improvised explosive devices, bombs, are made with various purposes in mind. Some are heavily laden with shrapnel, be it broken glass, be it nails, be it tacks. They're designed for one reason, to rip flesh. It's very possible this type of shrapnel was not included in this device, and it was meant to be a larger explosion that meant to, like, more, you know, damage buildings and infrastructure than to kill people. And, of course, the warning plays right into that. There's very few times in bombing incidents where you have warnings. The Irish Republican Army back in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s would do that sometimes, just to kind of, they blow up a monument or some kind of a British structure to get their point across, but they really didn't want to hurt people, although they still did. Mm-hmm. So here this guy is kind of taking it upon himself to do the same kind of warning, which is suggestive of the fact that he did not want to kill people. And I would, again, be curious to hear about the construction of the device itself. And it sounds like it may not have had too much in the way of shrapnel, although the RV itself would act as shrapnel components as it's being torn apart and blown across the area. And there's no doubt that's how the people got injured in some way, shape, or form. So I'm familiar with the AT&T sort of theory, the building there. And if that is the case, you know, was he an anti-tech guy like the Unabomber, or was it more more involved and more sophisticated than that in terms of his personal philosophy in terms of why this particular location? But I will say this, the location chosen was not a coincidence. And again, I'm not locking into any one feature here. He could have been, maybe he hadn't paid his AT&T bills, you know, phone bills in the last few months, and they shut off his system. And it could be something as simple as that. I've read about the whole 5G thing. He's against all this, you know, massive surveillance, whatever, Big Brother stuff. But I'm not locking into that at all. Let the investigation goes where it goes. And hopefully, you know, eventually there's a press conference or a report somewhere that the public has access to, because I'm still a profiler at heart, and I still like to hear the behavior involved and what is the causal factors behind these types of crime. And also, as a forensic linguist, I'd like to find out any of missives he may have written, any sort of manifestos, whether they're, you know, 35,000 words or 3,500. That would tell us a lot about this person. The Austin bomber from a few years ago, he apparently had a detailed sort of manifesto of sorts, but that was never released to the public. I know the FBI has a copy of it. I would love to have read that, but they thought that was too incendiary, no pun intended, and they didn't want it out there. So we'll see if this guy has something on his laptop, which I think they said they recovered, and that'll tell us a lot more about him.
James, one final question for you. You mentioned the that sometimes we see these manifestos, sometimes we don't. Do you think it's a better thing for us to see it and get some understanding from them? I can understand there might be reasons that law enforcement officials don't want to release them. How should we think about that?
Well, interesting question. I was one of the main proponents back in 1995 of releasing Unabomber's manifesto. Let's put it out there. First of all, that was a demand of his, a negotiating demand to stop killing people. So I think sometimes if it means identifying someone, like which did eventually work for us in the Unabomber case, it could be very critical to an investigation.
I think certainly a summary could be put out there for the public and certainly for academics and researchers in this field. They don't have to, of course, they can certainly, delete or excise parts of it. But I think, when a city block is blown up or multiple mm-hmm. blocks, I think the public has sort of a right to know at least what are the basics behind this person. And I don't think we see copycatters coming out of something like that, because these people have other reasons for doing what they're doing, and what one person puts in a manifesto may actually contradict what someone else puts in a manifesto, but the actions they're undertaking are the same. So, I think it should be released, or at least a summary version of that, especially since there should be no court case now, so it's not an evidentiary factor that could be problematic down the line. So, yeah, I'm always for transparency, and let's get it out there so we all know better how to look for these type of people in advance.
James Fitzgerald is a retired FBI supervisory special agent, criminal profiler, and forensic linguist, member of the Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI. James, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, guys. Take care.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy. Very interesting conversation with James about the bombing in Nashville. And Joe, they say that the lowest form of commentary known to man is media criticism. Mm-hmm. But let's wallow for a moment here. I don't know if you remember the austere... austere religious leader obituary for the leader of ISIS that the New York Times wrote?
Oh, yeah.
They managed to outdo themselves, I think. Here is the headline of one of their stories about the Nashville bombing. A quiet life, a thunderous death, and a nightmare that shook Nashville. Or, American suicide bomber targets Nashville in Christmas Day attack.
Yeah, it's just getting too cute with your words and trying to be... I mean, just report the news. You're not trying to be a wordsmith.
You don't have to
here.
Be profound.
Yeah.
Just deliver the facts about what has happened in a way that doesn't make you look like a buffoon, like calling the head of ISIS an austere religious figure.
More often than not, I think when you try to be profound, you just sound pretentious. You just sound like you're out of touch with what you're writing about.
Yeah, if we want to bring this full circle, you talked about the wonders of indoor plumbing and toilets there. I think it wouldn't be necessary at the New York Times, because I'm fairly sure that no one there has an anus. So that they don't need to participate in the wonder of indoor plumbing and toilets and all of that, because, it's just not a problem that they have.
No. Yeah. And if it does, I think they believe that it does not stink. So
yes. Yes. Very, very clearly. So that is what they believe.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.